Blog Talk Radio.
To the Eastern Airlines Radio Show, where we come to you each Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our hosts this evening are Steve Thompson, Margaret Bars, Chuck Albright, George Jen, Jim Graybill, Neil Holland, and me, Jim Hart. Our telephone number is 213-816-1611. Let me repeat that. 213-816-1611. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-877-572-1861. That one again is 1-877-572-1861. And be sure to press number 1 on your phone keypad to come in to the host queue. Our show tonight takes us up from where we left off last week with the history of the Eastern Airlines Air Shuttle. We hope our guests will have additional comments about their impressions of the shuttle. Funny, sad, mad, shocked, thrilled, amazed, or a few of the adjectives that can be told about the Air Shuttle. And hopefully, one or all will be shared in a repartee sort of way. Always wanting to bring a smile to our audience.
Hey, Jim.
Repartee.
Hey, Jim.
Yes.
Yes, we have a wonderful little ad that Eastern ran, and we want to play that to introduce the air shuttle again, which we did last week, and we just want to add a few more comments to our show last week. So let's listen to this little ad that I found tucked away on the internet, very hard to find. I didn't even know it existed, but it was an ad back in the late 50s, early 60s. So let's see if any of you can recognize it.
Had to be during the 60s when the shuttle started.
Yep, scramble. Let's not keep them waiting.
At the Eastern Air Shuttle, we have a crew on standby whose sole mission is to fly you to Boston or Washington whenever one of our regular shuttle planes is full. And for that reason, we at the Eastern Air Shuttle Service can guarantee you something no other airline can. A seat. The Eastern Air Shuttle, a guaranteed seat without a reservation.
Yeah, now, that's exactly right. That song did come out in the early 60s. Jim, you made a good point, because the shuttle didn't start, I believe. Didn't we say last week that it started around 1961? It was thought of back in the late 50s.
No, it was after that, Neil. It was around 62 or 63.
Okay.
I was flying the shuttle, Neil, in early 62.
Okay, well, we're within a year. I think that's close enough, don't you think?
I was still in high school then, so
okay.
I don't remember.
Thanks a lot, guys.
But, hey, we found somebody younger than me.
Let me ask our host, did any of you, I think, Steve, you mentioned that you flew the shuttle, or did any of you, Jim Graybill, I know I flew a couple of trips when I had TDY up in New York, when they sent me from Atlanta. But Steve, didn't you say you flew a shuttle or two?
I flew all three airplanes on the shuttle,
The first was a Connie, and second the Electra, and the third was the DC-9.
Wow, I'm
it was fun, fun, fun.
Yeah, I flew the started out with the Electra, and they shipped me back to the Connie, and then DC-7.
Okay, they didn't have the 7 on the shuttle, did they?
Yeah, from Washington to Boston.
No, I don't remember that, Jim.
I know they had the Martin 404 as a
backup. Every 2 hours from Washington to Boston.
Wow, my golly. Yeah, and then, George, I think you mentioned the fact that wasn't there a A300 on the shuttle? Or
yes,
somehow
there was. I flew the 727 on the shuttle, both on the scheduled trips and as standby. And then when the Airbus came over to Eastern, I flew the Ayatollah A300s. We flew them only from LaGuardia to Boston, not to Washington, because the feds wouldn't allow them into Washington, although there were some test flights that were done in there. I believe that Tom Butchin flew those trips in there, but the FAA never approved it for Washington National, now known as Reagan Airport.
Yeah. Well, I was there during the blizzard of 1978, and I was up there, best I can recall, about 3 months, and I had the occasion to fly a few shuttle flights. I never did get a bid. It was just up there on standby, and I did fly a couple of trips and impressed the way the operation ran. Boy, I tell you, they really knew their stuff, those guys on the line, the maintenance guys. It was really precise work. And as we mentioned last show, it was really an airline within an airline.
Yeah, it sure was. Does anybody remember the maintenance supervisor that's on the line? He, fairly tall gentleman, walked with a limp.
Gee, I sure don't remember.
I don't remember.
He could talk you into taking a bull elephant, I think.
Well, one thing I remember about the shuttle on the 727s especially, there were a number of those that were also configured for shuttle only, meaning there was no first class.
Yeah.
But the backup aircraft were usually 727-100s or QCs, and those, of course, had first class in them. So when there was a backup, the people used to quay in line to get on the airplane first, because then they could grab the first class seats.
Yeah. Well, I was impressed with Jim's knowledge of those guys that actually started, were responsible, and I guess for thinking up the idea when they were over with American. Jim, can you recall some of those guys that actually were responsible for originating the shuttle?
Oh yes, Frank Sharp, of course, was one of the key figures, and he, along with Bill Cambray, I think Sam Higginbottom got in there somewhere too. Bob Wynn, remember the name?
Yeah. Was there any? Go ahead, Jim.
No, we had so many different fellas involved with the program, but I'll tell you, Frank Sharp was the key individual, and you remembered some of the conversations he had with I think it was either Captain Eddy or Malcolm McIntyre. Of course, Floyd Hall came in a little bit later, but Malcolm McIntyre had a lot to do with it. In fact, I think they named one of the terminals for Malcolm McIntyre. I remember working with his wife. Mrs. McIntyre created a cookbook, and she sent the cookbook free of charge to all of the Eastern Airlines wives all over the system. Can you imagine?
Have you seen that on eBay?
No.
No, I don't think so.
It was on there last week. I don't know where it's gone now or not, but I remember looking at that.
My golly. Yeah.
The most fun fun part of the shuttle, for at least for me, was the standby. Of course, now I was working on a law degree while I was on standby, but you've got so many ferry flights and repositioning of equipment, and you could have fun on those ferry flights. And I won't go into all the details, but I do recall, and I was reminded of this by the flight attendant who was involved in it. We were on a shuttle. We were on a ferry flight from Washington to New York on a Connie. And one of the flight attendants said, well, so-and-so is going back to the restroom, and I'll let you know when she gets back there. Well, she came up and told us so-and-so is in the restroom. Well, we did a series of positive and negative G's, and I don't know what the result was, but it did not go over very well with the lady in the John.
Pantyhose were down around her ankles.
Also, you remember last week that I told you about a pattern or a practice that was performed by some students who lived in Washington and went to school in New York, that they would take their laundry out and check it in a duffel bag back to Washington, and their mother would come to the airport, get the duffel bag, wash the clothes, and send them back to New York. And this is all, of course, unchecked baggage. And worked very well until somebody got the better part of it. It's put a stop to it, I think.
Well, you know, in the corridor that the air shuttle operated, there were so many politicians traveling back and forth. And I heard a couple of stories by flight attendants when I was up there about who was on their flight. And one was telling me about Lyndon Johnson being on the flight, and there was a bulkhead there, and he was in the seat row, and he had his cowboy boots up off the floor and pushed against that forward bulkhead. And she asked him to please take his feet down, and of course he wouldn't do it, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And he was that type of guy, you know, Lyndon Baines Johnson. But I'm sure, do you, Jim Graybill, or Steve, remember any of the celebrities or politicians on your flights?
I had, what's his name, a comedian on two or three times.
Aren't they all comedians?
But anyway, as I remember, back in 61, when my class was hired, a total of 13 people, we were told that because of the air shuttle was the reason that we were hired. And then, of course, in the infamous 272 group, after we got in on that, it was on the shuttle, I guess, from 62 till almost 65. But I've got it marked down in my logbook. We were halfway between LaGuardia and Washington National when it came on the radio about our president being shot.
Oh, that was Kennedy being shot. That was in 63 then.
Yeah,
I was based in Washington during that time also, and I had the day off. I think everyone remembers what they were doing and when it happened. But the shuttle was quite a operation, and I'm sure the flight attendants have all the best stories about the air shuttle.
And you mentioned about the gals somebody going to the restroom. We were ferrying a lecturer from New York back to Washington, and the girls were laying on that little round table in the back. And one of the gals came up and said, look here in the back. And we did that little oscillation. Three of them were clinging to everything they could on the overhead. And
oh, my.
What do you guys
What little oscillation were you talking about?
Yeah, Dutch roll, probably.
With your rudders or with the elevators? Which one?
With the elevator.
The elevator.
At one time or another, all of the above. But the, for this one, was we did a semi-zero Zeta thing back there. And they were up on overhead.
So they had a little aeronautical, the astronaut weightlessness.
Well, I was
talking about Linda Johnson story.
It's a sad thing when you think about what happened this last week with our congressmen and senators. When they learned, this week, of course, they're all off, but when they learned that they might be delayed getting home, it didn't take them long to pass a law to rescind those air controller layoffs. It didn't take them long at all. It's just terrible. It irks me to think that whenever they can do something that is for their benefit, they can get things done real fast.
Yeah.
But it comes to us, the poor people of the public, to hell with us.
Yeah.
Well, I have a little bit of a story to go along with that. This is George, and I was flying an Airbus trip from LaGuardia to Boston. This was like in the early or mid-80s. And who gets on the aircraft but Ted Kennedy? And he stuck his head in the cockpit and, you know, in his usual Boston accent, oh, how's the crew doing? And I turned around and I said to him, oh, Mr. Kennedy, I said, I want to thank you for destroying so many lives by supporting the airline deregulation bill. And he never said another word. He just wheeled around and walked back to his seat.
Good for you.
Good.
Yeah.
What did you guys say about comedians being out of work?
I think we've got a little repartee going here.
That's right.
We'll have a little bit more in just a few minutes. But first of all, we have a dedication that we'd like to do tonight for our listeners. And host, perhaps you remember this gentleman as well. Margaret?
Well, we'd like to talk just for a moment about George Jones, and he was certainly a definitive country singer of the last half century. You know, his songs about heartbreak and hard drinking echoed his own turbulent life. Sadly, he died on Friday in Nashville at age 81. Now, you know, fans heard in his songs the strains of a life in which success and excess battled for decades. But, you know, he was never a crossover act. His country fans revered him, and he never wore a cowboy hat. Now, one of his famous songs, which actually became number one country hit in 1959, was White Lightning. And, you know, it's been reported that it required 83 takes because Mr. Jones was drinking throughout those sessions. But, Mr. Producer, can we find that song in our archives?
Let's take a quick look here, Margaret, and see if we can come up with that.
That'd be great.
Lightning.
Well, in North Carolina, way back in the hill, lived my old pappy and he had him still. He blew the white lightning till the sun went down. Then he filled him a jug and he passed it around. Mighty, mighty pretty and Baptist corn squeezing.
Ooh, white lightning.
Well, a team in a revenue too, searching for a place to remain a brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept a cooking.
Ooh, white lightning.
Ready for me now, host?
Look, Joe, not now. I'll let you know.
Well, ask my old pappy why he called it true. What lightning did the mountain do? I took a little sip and right away I knew. Had my eyes bugged out and my face turned blue. Lightning started flashing, thunder started clashing.
Ooh, what lightning.
Well, a team in the revenue too, searching for a place where they made fruit. They were looking
kind of looking, but my pappy kept a cooking.
White lightning.
Another one, another song that we'd like to play in honor of Mr. George Jones, and this was one of his number one hits on the country charts in April 1980. In fact, the Country Music Association named it Song of the Year, and he won the Grammy for Best Male Country Performance, and I'm sure a lot of you will remember this song, He Stopped Loving Her Today. Mr. Producer, let's play that one too.
He said, I'll love you till I die. She told me for him. I watched the years pass slowly by. She still prayed on his mind. He kept her pictures on his wall. Saw him go half crazy now and then. Oh, but he still loved her through it all. He kept hoping she'd come back again.
George, I read that part of going up. I hit the breaking news and then I hit breaking news.
Found love letters by his bed. Did it night. In 62, he had underlined in red every single I love you. I went to see my friend today. Oh, but I didn't see no tears. All dressed up to go away. First time I'd seen him smile on you. He stopped loving her. They placed a ring on his soul. And soon stop loving her today.
You know, Margaret, you told me, did you just mention that he was married to Tammy Wynette?
He was for several years, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And they did quite a few duets together, and so it was really, really popular.
Yeah.
I know my parents love their songs and have some of their old albums.
Any of you guys remember George Jones?
Yeah, but that was a very turbulent marriage, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting all the time.
Yes.
Now, she passed away before he did. Is that correct?
Yeah, she passed away when she was only 55 years old. So I can't remember what year it was.
It was a while back, probably.
Yeah.
At least, what, 10 years?
Was she married to Glenn Campbell for a while?
Did he sing with Glenn Campbell? I'm not certain whether he did or not.
I don't think he sang with Glenn Campbell, but I thought Campbell was married to her at one time.
Oh,
Tammy Wynette?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know.
I may be wrong there.
Yeah. I didn't follow George Jones. There are a few other singers that. But later on, I heard a few of his songs, and pretty good. They're really good. I wonder if he wrote his own songs.
That last song that you played really stirred up some bad air in this room. It's just affecting my eyes.
I admire that in a man, though, Steve. I think that's great.
Don't tell anybody that.
Hey, I was trying to give you an out.
Well, we want to include a little song with all of our broadcasts. I think it kind of livens it up and gives it a little variety.
Actually, I just looked it up, Neil. Tammy Wynette died in 1998.
Mm-hmm. So she's been dead a few years, 15 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Boy, I tell you what, those performers, those especially singers, really lead a hard life, don't they?
Yeah, you're on the road every night.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kind of like an airline pilot.
Yeah, but they get better food.
Who does, the pilots or the singers?
Singers.
Well, they got all those. They got all those motorhomes. I do have some interesting news. Just a moment, please. If you'll bear with the producer. Breaking news. George, what do you have?
This is the one pertaining to the potential second barrier to the airline cockpits.
Yes, that's breaking news.
Well, it was datelined, I believe it was today, and I don't know who put it out, but it says a widow of a pilot who died on one of the jets that crashed into the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, is gaining congressional support in her campaign to add another barrier to airliner cockpits. Ellen Saracini, widow of United Airlines Flight 175 Captain Victor Saracini, says a flaw persists with cockpit doors, which have been reinforced since 2001 to prevent another attack. She says they're open several times during flights, which could let a terrorist get through and seize control. Pilots groups have also called for using secondary barriers to prevent the sort of actions that concerns Saracini. U.S. Representative Michael Fitzpatrick, a Pennsylvania Republican, says legislation is needed to complete the job started after the terrorist attack to ensure another airliner can't be turned into a guided missile. Quote, "For the minimal cost and maximum protection provided, this is a no-brainer," unquote, Fitzpatrick said in an interview. Saracini wrote to President Barack Obama outlining the need for additional cockpit protections in March, a week after the Transportation Security Administration said it planned to let passengers carry now-banned pocket knives aboard on domestic trips. Flight attendants, air marshals, and airport screeners came out against the change, prompting a delay by the agency. Then the article goes on. The TSA's move shocked his constituents and defied common sense, Fitzpatrick said. He also worried about reports airlines that were voluntarily installing secondary barriers have stopped, citing costs and added weight. Quote, 12 years after 9/11, we seem to be getting too complacent, Fitzpatrick said. We should be protecting the public instead. We're rolling back the protections of 9/11, unquote. The Airline Pilots Association, a union, has advocated for regulations on second barriers for years. An industry committee at RTCA Incorporated, a non-for-profit organization that advises the Federal Aviation Administration, has studied the issue and published guidelines. The guidance is intended to guarantee easy installation and maintenance and to keep down added weight while ensuring adaptability for future aircraft designs. The devices would be put in place before the cockpit door is opened to provide more time for members of the crew to react should someone try to barge in. One barrier shown in a union white paper looks like a fence attached to cabin walls. At least 10 hijacking attempts since 2007 show the need to do more, according to a congressional fact sheet. Airlines began installing secondary barriers on their own in 2003, while their interest has waned since 2010, it said. And that's the end of the story.
Well, I can't picture in my mind the type of barriers the extra security from going into the cockpit. But you can easily see that once the cockpit door is open, let's say that the flight attendant's delivering coffee or crew meals to the pilots, it's an opportune time to barge in, and I'm not sure how that's done anymore, but I was thinking of two doors with a little space in between where you had to go through one door and then put a card in to open the cockpit door or something like that. Any thoughts along?
Yeah, don't the Israelis or the Russians have that in their aircraft?
What, Chuck?
Yeah, I can't remember which one. It's either the Israelis or the Russians have a double door in their aircraft. And they've had them for a long time, so, I mean, it's feasible to do it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see where they say it's going to be a big expense or increase the weight on an aircraft where you'd have to worry about fuel or anything.
No.
Well,
I don't either.
Let me ask a question here, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but if my memory serves me correctly, the hijackers on 9/11 were led into the cockpit and were sitting on the jump seats because they had false identification cards and they had uniforms that they had purchased, even though they were not pilots for the airlines they purported to be working for. So, and the reason I bring that up is I recall that immediately following 9/11, the FAA issued a directive that you could sit in the cockpit on the jump seat only if you were employed by that particular carrier. But if you worked for another airline, you could still get a free ride, but there had to be room in the cabin for you. And I believe it was due to that reason. So I don't know. I really don't know if the problem exists to the extent that some people claim it does. And the reason I say that is, let's say, for example, that a hijacker would take a hostage. It demanded that the door be opened. I mean, would it make any difference if it were one or two doors? I mean, that to me would probably be the most likely scenario. And if the case, as I outlined in 9/11, was true, that would actually have had no effect whatsoever on that.
Well, you know, George, D.B. Cooper, as you recall, never went to the cockpit.
Right.
He displayed a bomb in an attaché case. The flight attendant saw it and believed it and convinced the crew that he had it.
That's correct.
So
you're going to come up with a scenario that, fortunately, they won't let them take pocket knives, but something, say if they did, and some hijacker had the pocket knife, and he did have somebody as a hostage. Now the captain has to weigh the probability of one life against 100 and some odd lives in the airplane. And that could possibly happen.
You know,
good old days are gone, guys.
What was that?
I said the good old days are gone.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have a question, Neil. I wonder if, since 9/11, are we going to all of the different airline training schools to make certain that they're not training again people that could pose a problem?
That was in the news here last week or 2 weeks ago, Jim Hart. That the FAA, I believe it's the FAA, or either Homeland Securities, was going and looking at the flight schools and the students that are enrolled from foreign countries, and they've already discovered hundreds of folks that are here illegally taking flight training.
Oh.
Mm-mm-mm.
Do we ever learn?
Here we go again. Right.
Yeah.
Stop the world. I want to get off.
Yeah.
The same applies to corporate flying. I mean, I just had a nephew who flew down to Washington on a corporate jet, and he said they just walked out on the tarmac and got on the aircraft. And there's absolutely no security for those.
George, that's interesting because a Gulfstream 4 or 5 or whatever they're up to now, that airplane could make quite an impact into a structure, if commandeered by a terrorist.
They don't have to commandeer it. All they have to do is sign a contract.
Yeah. And
so I want to lease this plane for a month.
That's right.
Or
take a trip to the islands and then head for whatever their objective was.
Right.
Well, you know, the amount of money that these high rollers spend on these G5s, 6s, and 650s, they can do just about whatever they want.
Well, stop the presses. New Virgin American System encourages mile-high flirting with their new in-flight pickup service.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Sounds
so
good.
You think the person sitting across the aisle on your flight is cute? Well, don't just sit there. Send over a drink or a bag of $8 pretzels. Because Virgin America has launched a new service that allows people the ability to send drinks, a meal, or a snack to fellow passengers that catch their eye. And listen to this. You just locate them on Virgin's digital seat map, which is on the back of the seat. You browse the menu, and you have a drink, a snack, or a meal sent over. And you can follow it up with a text message. And this service is available on all Virgin American flights, and it uses the company's RED in-flight entertainment system. And so Virgin announced this service to mark its latest expansion in Las Vegas, connecting flights from Vegas to Los Angeles. And listen to this, Neil and EAL listeners and hosts, the company's CEO, Sir Richard Branson, said in a release that there's a 50% chance you may meet someone using the new flirty service. So here's what I want to ask. Is this clever marketing or creepy marketing?
Both.
Well, one thing is for certain. What happens in Vegas no longer stays in Vegas.
That's true.
I think Luann would like it, though.
Hey, Luann, I was there in September, and I tried to keep everything secret, but I don't know. It's all over Facebook now.
What's this world coming to?
I'm telling you.
Well, I think that started in the bars. Didn't some of the bars years ago, the lounges, have that telephone service right there?
Yeah.
The bar and
well, you know, I think this brings...
Who said yes? Is that you, Chuck?
I think that was Neil. That was the places around LaGuardia. They had those.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, I think this takes stalking to a new level. I mean, you know, as a single woman, I can't imagine anything better than having some crazy person text me and send me a drink. And then all of a sudden, if I reject him, does that mean he follows me in life and I can't get off the plane?
And for environment, the guy might say, would you like to step out on the wing and have a drink with me?
No, that's not going to happen. You're going to step somewhere, but it's not going to be out on the wing.
Well, my comment would be, well, of course, sir, you should go first.
I'm sure they'll probably put two flight crews on those flights.
You know, but I'm sure that the younger generation will love this, you know, I mean, because they're into social media. But for those of us that, are older, I can't think of anything more annoying than that. I think when I'm on a plane and I'm a white-knuckle flyer anyway, I certainly don't want anyone talking to me.
Well, they've already had the novelty of an airline that was created for the mile-high flyers. And that need I say any more? No.
It all goes downhill from there.
Well, that's all the breaking news we have tonight. And, Jim, could you tell us a little bit about this repartee that we can talk the rest of the show?
Yes, I will.
Funny, sad man.
You know, as a matter of fact, one of Eastern Air Association's member publications is aptly called Repartee. It seems that after the retired Eastern Pilots Association had no official name other than newsletter, a member catching the drift of most retirees contributing their thoughts, memories, and stories suggested Repartee. That's Repartee, which became the Origin's official name. What's the definition in Webster? It's a quick and witty reply. It's a succession of interchange of clever retorts, or it's amusing and usually light sparring with words. That's what Webster has to say. Funny, sad, mad, shocked, thrilled, amazed are a few of the adjectives that can be told about the air shuttle. And hopefully, one or all will be shared in a repartee sort of way. Always wanting to be a smile to our audience with some witty repartee, those of us in aviation seem to be experts in this category. As a matter of fact, one of our Eastern Association's member publications is aptly called Repartee. It seems that after the retired Eastern Pilots Association had no official name other than newsletter, a member catching the drift of most retirees contributing their thoughts.
Time, Jim. This is the producer. I think we've looped this recording and repeating it, but I think we can say that a lot of pilots flying airplanes and flight attendants, I'm sure, pilots were not back in the back listening to the flight attendant conversations, but I'm sure a lot of repartee was spoken in the cabin. But a lot of it that all the pilots know how witty each one thinks that they can be wittier than the other. And so the word repartee, I guess, is from the French usage of it in fencing. You know, the thrust, you get your back without really causing any other damage than getting the best of the person that tried to say something that you didn't particularly care for. But, Jim, over on page 2.
Yep, I got it. I've been interested.
I know you've been interested in some comebacks.
Am I okay?
Yeah, you're okay to go.
I've been interested in comebacks and retorts for more than 40 years. I'm not absolutely certain, but the first great repartee story I recall hearing came when I was an undergraduate at the University of North Dakota in the 1960s. Told by one of my psychology professors, it was a classic tale about Winston Churchill and Lady Astor. Nancy Astor, you'll recall, was an American socialite who married a wealthy Englishman and then used her marriage as a springboard into the top tier of English society. She holds the distinction, of course, of being the first woman to take a seat in Parliament. At a 1912 dinner party, Lady Astor became annoyed at an inebriated Churchill who was pontificating on some topic. Reaching the end of her patience, she blurted out, "Winston, if you were my husband, I'd put poison in your coffee." And Churchill famously replied, "I would do the same." Steve.
Well, stories about swift and witty replies have been told for many centuries. And some for many centuries. And some wonderful stories go way back into antiquity. One of my favorites was told by the Greek writer Plutarch in Parallel Lives, a book he wrote in the first century A.D. One charming story involved a Greek nobleman named Antigonus. One day after learning that his adult son, Demetrius, was ill, Antigonus decided to pay a home visit. Arriving at the front door of his son's house, the concerned father ran head-on into a beautiful young woman who brushed quickly by as she was leaving. Slightly puzzled, Antigonus went straight to his son's bedroom. As he placed his hand on his son's forehead, he asked, "How are you feeling?" The son looked up weakly, and with a soft voice, he said, "The fever has just left me, I think." Antigonus replied knowingly, "Yes, I know. I met it going out the door."
Well, happily clever replies are not a thing of the past. Indeed, clever new examples are being documented every day, some of them coming from the most famous names of our time. A few years ago, Jennifer Lopez was asked what she got on her SATs. She cleverly dodged the question and earned the admiration of all within earshot when she answered, "Nail polish."
Yep. These anecdotes are a perfect example of repartee, which Oxford English Dictionary defines this way: a ready, witty, or smart reply, a quick and clever retort. Sharpness, or wit and sudden reply, which replies collectively in the practice or the facility of uttering them. We talk more about words and terms, but the words originally come from a French fencing term, which we had discussed before. It was answering a blow or a thrust. Jim?
Repartee stories pay homage to those rare individuals who often, under duress, are able to keep their heads and deliver a swift and witty reply. Most of us admire wit under pressure because we don't fare nearly so well in such pressure-filled situations. Many of us stammer or get tongue-tied, and if we do think of a clever response, it comes to mind long after the moment when it was needed. This phenomenon is called staircase wit, and it comes from the French expression esprit de la scala.
The word repartee often conjures up interaction marked by a quick exchange of clever remarks. And when it comes to repartee, nobody did it better than the members of that legendary collection of wits known as the Algonquin Round Table. A chapter of my book is devoted to Algonquin Round Table wit. For many decades, a delightful story has been told about one member of the group, the playwright Mark Connolly. One evening, Connolly was dining with friends when another member of the group snuck up from behind, placed his head on top of Connolly's bald head, and said to the amusement of the other guests, "Mark, your head feels as smooth as my wife's rear end." Connolly raised his hands up to his head, began rubbing his own scalp, and with a wry smile said, "So it does, so it does."
Very good, very good.
Well, have you ever been humiliated by the verbal abuse of a loudmouth bully, lost the power of human speech, find yourself mumbling unintelligible monosyllable words when replying to the arrogance of a conceited and self-centered person? Or perhaps you just suffer in silent agony from the pontifical hooey of an unknowing know-it-all. Well, you know, the best advice is just stay clear of them. But unfortunately, that's not always possible. So try using witty repartee and insulting comebacks that rebound to your advantage. And what are insulting comebacks? Well, it's a pointed barb of sarcasm clothed in polite term. Like a riposte, a witty repartee parries an opponent's thrust and counterattack with a conversation stopper. The perfect squelch to the boastfulness of a pompous fool, delivering a direct missile hit to the person's ego with devastating effect. And to bring about a quick resolution to an unwarranted confrontation, it's not necessary to step down to name-calling or using profanity and obscene language. You can still insult and express contempt in a tactful and tasteful manner. So here's some witty repartee and insulting comebacks from folks in the airline business. Chuck?
One day I was having lunch in the employee's cafeteria on 36th Street when a young man came and sat just across the table from me. He commenced to masticate his food in an awful show of bad manners, his mouth grinding openly away at his contents and even bits of food flying into his and my tray. I couldn't take it anymore. Picked up the remaining lunch on my tray to a close to another table far away from this guy as possible. I had to tell him what I thought of his annoying manners and said, "You know, you're a good example of why some animals eat their young."
I used to fly with this captain that made life miserable for co-pilots that had the misfortune of flying a trip with him. His name was always on the bathroom wall in flight operations, and I suspect his name also appeared on the flight attendant's bathroom wall as well. News spread quickly of his passing without much fanfare from his coworkers. The captain on my next trip asked if I had attended the funeral, and I told him no, but I sent a nice letter saying I approved of it. Now, here are some examples of repartee. "I feel so miserable without you. It's almost like having you here." Stephen Bishop. "I regard you with an indifference bordering on aversion." Robert Louis Stevenson. "He hasn't an enemy in the world, but all of his friends hate him." Eddie Cantor. "Sometimes I need what only you can provide is your absence." Ashley Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Chuck.
Well, you know, there was a flight attendant, engineer on 720, correction, 727, Miami up to New York. And this gentleman was very in such a ruckus in the back. He was smoking a cigar. And I remember the captain sent me back there, and when he saw me coming, and you could hear him from one end of the cabin to the other. Anyway, long story short, we wound up landing in Philly to have this gentleman taken home. He got down to the bottom of the stairs, and he turned around and said something to the flight attendant, and without her hesitating, she said, "Well, sir, if you do with that cigar what you want me to do with this airplane, you can get back on."
That's good. That's great.
That's great.
Chuck, you got some more?
Yeah, I got one here. "I'm reserving two tickets for you for my premiere. Come and bring a friend, if you have one. George Bernard Shaw, Winston Churchill. Impossible to be present for the first performance. We'll attend second, if there is one," Churchill replied. Another one would be, "Fine words. I wonder where you stole them," Jonathan Swift. "He has never known to use a word that might send a reader to the dictionary."
Oh.
William, about Ernest Hemingway. Poor Faulkner. "Does he really think big emotions come from big words?" Ernest Hemingway, about William Faulkner. "From the moment I picked up your book until I laid it down, I was convulsed with laughter. Someday I intend to read it." Groucho Marx. We've already done the last one there. The last,
you know,
two. There's one after that. "You will either die on the gallows or of a lonesome disease," John Montague to John Wilkes. "That depends on whether I embrace your principal or your mistress," John Wilkes, in reply.
Very good. You know, we've got several more that we can deliver tonight, but we're really quickly running out of time, and just a quick discussion of repartee. First of all, it's an appropriate name for the Retired Eastern Pilots Association's official organ, a publication that comes out twice a year now. But over the past 35-plus years, that magazine has produced some fantastic repartee. And the pilot that so named it really did came up with an appropriate name. And it indicates that that person thought that REPA, Retired Eastern Pilots Association, and adding RTEE came up with what that magazine is full of. And some interesting reading. And by the way, listeners, if you would like a CD of over 35 years of that wonderful magazine that is published under the editorship of Jim Holder, Captain Jim Holder from Atlanta, we have a few copies that we can send you. So just contact us page on www.ealradioshow.com, and give us a comment or an address where we can send you one, and we'd be happy to do so. And it's really great reading, and it's all in PDF, and you can expand it to whatever size your eyes feel comfortable with. And let's see, any other comments from our host before we sign off? We're approaching a few minutes. That any comments? It's been a good show. It's gone. The hour has gone quickly.
Yes, it has, very quickly. It was a great show.
George, thanks so much for being with us. And by the way, I want to put in a plug. Shouldn't be necessary, because George Jen's book, Flying Too Close to the Sun, is really taking off. It has gotten a lot of recognition, and thanks to our listeners, and we hope all of our listeners will recommend that book to their friends, because it's really good reading. It's about 300 plus pages of an exciting adventure, mystery novel, I should say, and with a surprising ending. George, you did a great job in doing that. By the way, can you quickly bring us up to date as to where the book is and the good news about someone's interested in perhaps doing something with it?
Yes. Thank you for the kind compliments on the book. Besides being available on Amazon now, it's also available on the Barnes & Noble website. I don't know if it's going to be in the stores there. I presume it will be. And that was kind of because of the book's popularity and the very nice comments that the readers have posted on Amazon pertaining to my book. And I really appreciate that, and I certainly appreciate all that everyone from the Eastern Radio Show has done to make it a success. And right now there is a major film studio that's looking at it, hopefully to make a movie out of it. So I don't know how long that process will take. I have no idea whatsoever. This is all my second career. It's all brand new to me. But it certainly is a lot of fun.
Very good. Quickly, we have a area code 321. Would you like to make a comment before we go off air?
Neil, you said you could get a CD of the REPA, the magazine, the repartee?
Yeah, I can.
Did you mean DVD or CD?
CD. So, Hal Nord, if that is you, is that Hal Nord?
You guessed it, Neil.
I've got one going out to you, Hal. We're just running out of time, just a few seconds left, and Hal, I will put that in the mail to you, and you'll enjoy that CD.
Yeah, it is a CD and not a DVD, correct?
That's a CD, so you can...
Okay.
Yeah, CD. Jim, would you take us out of here before we... out of time?
Yes, and it's good to hear Hal Nord's voice also. I hear the sign-off music in the background, so we must bring this show to an end. We intend to continue our next show with your thoughts and stories about the Eastern Airlines Air Shuttle. I know the hosts have a few they want to share as well. Until then, we hope you will tell your friends about the radio show and the history being broadcast each week about our beloved Eastern Airlines. We truly have become the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. Good night, Eastern people. Good night,
good
everyone.
Good night, Eastern.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Jim.
Good night.
Good night, Jim.
Good night.
I hear Luann. Good night, Luann.
Good night, Jim.
Okay.